RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Paul Thacker is an American investigative journalist based in Spain and founder of the Disinformation Chronicle, a newsletter that reports on corruption in science and medicine. He won a 2021 British Journalism Award for a series in the British Medical Journal that investigated the financial interests of medical experts advising US and UK governments during the COVID-19 pandemic. In a separate investigation he wrote for the BMJ, he looked at problems in the clinical trial for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. That article was the finalist for an investigative journalism award and is the most highly viewed article in all of science in 2021. And you can go to the BMJ to read about that. It's titled COVID-19 Researcher Blows the Whistle on Data Integrity Issues in Pfizer's Vaccine Trial. We've had Paul Thacker on this program before, back in late December last year, talking about science communications and its insidious influence on science reporting. This morning, he's back to discuss Peter Hotez, you know, the guy who wears the bow tie, suggesting using UN and NATO security forces to be used to combat anti-vaccine movements in the US, which he claims are responsible for significant deaths during the COVID-19 pandemic. Is he unhinged? And we'll also venture into the corruption and structural problems in science and science journalism. Paul Thacker, welcome back to Reality Check Radio, RCR.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Okay, Dr. Peter Hotez, first up, he wears a bow tie. What does that say?
Who wears a bow tie? It's like, I mean, it used to be for a long time, that was like very much a thing for like right-wingers in America. Then you had Nation of Islam wearing bow ties. I don't know. It's very much an affect, at least in the States. I don't know how it is where you are, but like in the States, it's definitely, it's someone who has an affected personality.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I wonder if his one spins.
I don't know, but I can tell you this right now. He is a favorite on MSNBC. He's like the most, he's MSNBC's most favorite physician to be on, to tell you why you need to wear masks, why you need a booster, why you need a second booster, why you need a third booster, a fourth booster of the fifth booster. He is MSNBC's favorite vaccine doctor.
Yeah, I've been aware of him, and I'm sure our listeners have for a while. He seems to revel in his, I don't know, notoriety, publicity, profile. You can kind of tell.
Well, you know, he had a whole situation where he was invited by Joe Rogan to come on and debate, I think RFK Jr., I think is who it was. And he, of course, turned that into, this is an attack on me, an attack. I mean, he'll take anything and convert it into an attack on science. Or if it's not an attack on science, it's a sign of, he goes through like a whole list of these things. It's Putin, it's Hitler, it's the Nazis, it's the anti-science. He has like a whole list of these things he just kind of rattles off. He's fond of hearing the sound of his own voice.
Yeah, that's that comes across. So what do you know about him, Paul? What's his background? How did he get to being so well favored by those kind of networks anyway?
Well, I mean, what's known about him is that he works in an area where he's dealing with a lot of, I think mostly like what are called orphan diseases, diseases that aren't normally getting a lot of attention. And he works on vaccines for those diseases. He's also like put out ideas that we need vaccines for things we don't really need vaccines for. Conditions where there's actually, you know, very simple treatments. It's kind of weird. He is now at a university in Texas, and I interviewed a physician at his university, a guy who was rotating through there, and he told me that he actually has, this is what the guy told me, he walked past his door, Hotez's door. He has kind of like a very heavy set door, and also the frame for it, like it's made for like a bomb. Like he's obviously like convinced the administration at his university that he's at threat of a possible bomb. And so he's got his a reinforced door going into his office. You know, after he was invited on Joe Rogan's show, These two people showed up at his house and were asking to talk to him, and they had it on, like, you know, they were shooting it with their iPhone or something like that. And it was so funny because, I mean, I get it. Like, I mean, I would not want to have someone show up at my door, you know, knocking on my door and asking me questions. But, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, if you're a famous person who's all over the news and you're the person who's making all these proclamations about masks, proclamations about how to deal with the vaccines, proclamations about how some people are Nazis and others aren't, and here's how you do the science, you know, you should expect people to, like, maybe show up at your door, you know, I don't know.
And it's on the cards. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, he turned this into that he was being stalked by anti-vaxxers, and the media just went with it. Like, suddenly all these stories appeared in the media about how he was being stalked. And it was so funny because you can actually go online and watch the video because the people posted the video. And it's just very innocuous. It's just like, hi, we'd like to talk to you about this. And he's like, well, this is kind of making me uncomfortable. I don't like, I mean, it was just so anodyne, but he turned it into, you see, they're coming after me. So he has this idea in his head that he's under assault and he's some sort of like a Luke Skywalker almost, you know, dealing with the force of evil. He's a superhero in his own head.
Some of what he's been saying, okay, using UN and NATO security forces, I think he said this or suggested it, that they be used to combat anti-vaccine movements in the United States. But I guess he means broader than that because, you know, we have our people here as well, which he claims are responsible for significant deaths during the COVID-19 pandemic. How do you think he gets to that?
I have no clue how he came up with his 200,000 Americans died because of anti-vaccine aggression. He oftentimes just, you know, throws things out there that he has sort of created in his own head and then, you know, claims them to be truth. He also, I mean, you should know this also, he is in love with Tony Fauci. He was one of the guys early on defending Fauci no matter what was going on. When about 2 years ago, when people first started really dialing up interest in Tony Fauci for funding research in Wuhan, Hotez came out of the blue, and Hotez started defending him and attacking scientists who were questioning what Tony Fauci was saying about his funding for Wuhan. And then it came out through, people were looking through Hotez's grants, he was funding research in Wuhan himself.
Oh, God.
Yeah. No, so like, I mean, the guy just, he's just one of these people who just gets on there and just starts, you know, rambling on. And when he makes mistakes, he never bothers to correct them. Another thing he did is caught him. He was going on television saying that kids should be wearing masks, parents should be masking their kids. And then you'd see photos of him that he was posting at public events, sometimes like with the mayor or, you know, just with a bunch of other doctors. And he's not wearing a mask. So he loves telling people what to do and then not taking his own advice. Here's another thing I found out. There's a scientist who pointed out that Hotez, he also denied the existence of natural immunity, which is so crazy. He's a physician. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, like, he loves to go out there and accuse everyone of anti-science, even as he, you know, puts out ideas and says things that are just so obviously against what scientific knowledge. You know, he does this repetitively over and over again. Oh, another one of his, the one that I caught him at was so hilarious. Early on in the pandemic, when the vaccines first started to become rolled out, or maybe it was even before they were being rolled, he said, well, there's this new meme popping up amongst right-wingers that there's going to be vaccine mandates. And this is all just part of the right wings. So that, and then, like, what happens? Like, there were mandates, of course. So, yeah. I mean, and then he doesn't bother to go back and ever think about what he said in the past. He just keeps moving on forward because he's so arrogant and narcissistic.
I think I saw Fauci just this week telling us that he had COVID for the third time after 6 shots. So yeah. Have you got anything to say about that? How do you think that's gone down?
I don't know. I think these guys, they constantly change the narrative. No matter, you know, I mean, first off, you know, I don't know how it was, I don't know how it was put out in New Zealand, but in the States, you can go back and look, and they were saying, if you get the vaccine, that's it. Like, you're not going to get COVID. You know, Rachel Maddow said this on MSNBC. the President Biden said this. Who else? I think, the CDC director also asserted this. And of course, like, you know, we know that that's not true, right? And then it was funny too, because then after a while, there was this incident that happened about a year after that, when there was a legislator, a member of one of the parliaments in Europe, asked Pfizer, like, did you ever test to see if this vaccine would stop transmission? And they said no. And then I was like, oh, you see, you never test. And then all these fact checks came out and said, but they never said that they tested for it. So like that, you know, the fact checkers then come and like, you know, surround and protect, you know, the vaccine industry. This is something that like, I think is becoming more and more clear as we look back on what happened during this pandemic. But Hotez was just part of this whole process of just, you know, just lying at times to people about what was going on during the pandemic. There's actually a guy named Matt Orfalea who does a lot of videos. He's like a video investigative reporter. He goes back and finds what people said in the past on news programs and such. He put together a pretty good video of Hotez just constantly contradicting himself back and forth. And then even though he does this, you know, the media will still call him up and have him back on TV again.
Right. Does anyone listen to him? Has he got a fan base at all, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think amongst researchers, like within the research community, you know, the medical research community, I think he does have, you know, quite a following. Although I think, you know, I mean, look, I had someone at his university send me a bunch of grand rounds. Grand rounds are when doctors speak to other doctors and, you know, for like, you know, brief little learning sessions. And during this grand round, this was back in 2021, right? So this is not just the recent talk he gave where he talked about deploying, you know, NATO and such. This is all the way back in 2021. And here's what he said on this grand round. He said, the problem is the disinformation empire is so vast and pervasive that until we do something more definitive to get to the source of the disinformation and stop it, it's not going to have that much of an impact. And that's where everybody moves away from me. And I tend to be out on my own here. So that's what he says, right? So even back then, he was acknowledging he knows he's extreme, right? He's out on a ledge. And he calls out actually the Surgeon General, like, I wish he would just go further. I wish he'd go farther. So he's just one of these guys who's cheerleading on the side. And then when you question what he says, then of course, then you're anti-science, because he is the science, just like Tony Fauci. He is the science.
Yeah, there's a lot of ego in this space, isn't there? It's become very clear, like massive egos.
Oh, I call it just, I mean, I've often in the last about, I think, year and a half, I've realized that like, I don't really write so much about issues in science so much. I write about people with dark triad personality traits, people who are, you know, who are narcissists, people who have psychopathic tendencies. You know, I mean, that's what I write out. These people are just, they're all about themselves. And everything that they say is themselves first, you know, and everyone else comes second.
Do we know what sort of money he makes? Because there's usually a follow the money element in these things.
Well, he claims over and over again that, you know, he takes no money from the vaccine industry, no money. I do everything, you know. I mean, he's a physician in you know, in America. He's at a university. I'm sure he's making, you know, $600,000-$800,000 a year. Like he's got a, you know, good salary. Any academic physician in the United States is, you know, wealthy. So, you know, and I don't like to make accusations against someone unless there's proof of this. You know, because it's not always money that guys, for a lot of these people, I mean, they're fame whores. I mean, they really are interested in being famous, seeing themselves on television, you know, in part because like, I know people who know some of these people, or I know people who've worked for some of these people. So I know how a lot of their thinking goes, and they're very interested in, you know, their public profile, being seen as, you know, someone hanging out with celebrities, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I suppose before COVID, there weren't too many opportunities to do that for someone like him.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, there were, but his talks that he were giving were more at like science conferences, right? So more for professional audiences. And then, you know, when COVID comes along, he, you know, begins to create this, you know, public persona for himself, and, you know, how he's going to fix all the problems in the world because of how smart he is and the books he writes and the essays that he writes and when he hops on TV. So he sees himself as a public figure. And yet whenever he gets public scrutiny, that's, of course, when he immediately reverts back into his, you know, this is what happened in the 1930s in Germany. This is what happened under Stalin. You know, neo-Nazis are on the march. You know, it's like the same thing over and over again. I just love the fact that, like, when he gave this talk, when he gave this talk back in 2020, he called it the disinformation empire. And that's where I came up with this idea that he sees himself as Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, with a lightsaber.
Hand. A lightsaber of truth.
Yeah. Surely, though, the game will be up soon because the, you know, we've moved on. The information has changed. There's a certain degree of waking up going on. He's on borrowed time, isn't he? And people like him.
Well, I think, yes. I mean, you know, I mean, I've often thought that what happened during this pandemic was kind of like, so when I was a kid growing up, you know, back in 1980, there was a series that came out in the States called Magnum P.I.
Oh, yeah, we know that.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. And so what was interesting is you know, I was a kid. I was 10 years old at the time when it came out in 1980. And I remember, and I knew as a kid that there had been World War One, there'd been World War Two, there'd something had happened in Korea. We had had a civil war. So I kind of like, and I remember asking my mom, like, Mom, was there a war in Vietnam? Yeah. Because in America, like, we didn't want to talk about this. I don't feel like during the 70s, like, I just remember it was something that people didn't talk about. And then Magnum PI came along and suddenly you could talk about the Vietnam War. Here's these guys that were former, you know, they were Vietnam War veterans, you know, a lot of the cast were. And I think that's kind of where we're at right now with a lot of this stuff about the pandemic. I think a lot of people don't want to talk about it right now, but they know something weird happened. And I think a lot of this is going to catch up to people. Because, I mean, people now, in retrospect, they look back, like, no one's defending going into Vietnam. Like, no one's, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there are some crazy, you know, right-wingers out there who just, yeah, we should have, like, bombed them more. But I think for the most part, people kind of understand that Vietnam was a debacle. And I think that that's kind of where we're going to reach with this whole pandemic, is that people are going to look back on the things that happened. You know, I was just looking through an article I tripped across talking about masks in New York Magazine in 2020. And I'm reading this article thinking, like, this stuff is so stupid. Like, some of the things that they were saying were so obviously wrong and stupid. And some of the references they were going, one of the people they referenced was this guy who runs a blog. And he's a designer. But he had this thing up about, like, which masks are best. And they referenced this, a news site run by a guy who's a designer who was just happened to be blogging about masks. And so I think what's going to happen is we're going to look back on this and people are going to go back and look at some of the things that happened and realized how stupid and crazy some of our actions were. And the Peter Hoteses and the Tony Faucis and some of these other, you know, doctors and, you know, public figures are just going to look crazy and stupid. I just wrote a piece for Unheard about one of these characters, a woman named Zeynep Tufekci, who's now a columnist at the New York Times. She was the one who helped to alter mask policy in America. And she did it we know she did it because she's praised for it in the New York Times, that she changed mask policy with tweets, a tweet storm, and an essay in the New York Times. And so I looked into her background. She doesn't have any training in medicine or public health. She's a sociologist. And then when you go back and look even further, like, she has no really good training in sociology. You know, she's someone who just kind of rose up and then suddenly decided, like, masks work. And what's funny is the month before she like wrote her essay in the New York Times saying that masks work and that helped to alter CDC policy, she then went on to, like, you know, tell the World Health Organization, you know, we should have masks. The month prior, she wrote an article in Scientific American saying, don't worry, masks don't work. So she was part of this whole, like, what, man, I call the great mask flip-flop of March of 2020, where everyone came out and everyone who said before don't worry, masks don't work, suddenly came out and said masks work. And that's her. That's Tony Fauci did the same thing. Jenny Harries, who is the COVID advisor to the UK or England, she did the same thing, as well as, I'm blanking on the woman's first name, but Dr. Tam, who was the COVID advisor for Canada. She also did a 180. So they all did this 180 where suddenly they're like, don't worry about masks. And they're like, you know, oh yeah, everyone needs to wear a mask. You know, and so there were a lot of things like this that happened during the pandemic that just in retrospect don't make sense. And I don't think people picked up on it at the time, or if they did, they were drowned out by the, you know, by the mainstream media that was just chortling along with, you know, whatever, you know, the CDC was telling them to say.
It's kind of insane when I'm listening to you there, that someone who knows nothing about anything but can get a, you know, a few stories out there and a bit of influencing, and suddenly, you know, the whole world's sort of following almost. It's crazy stuff. Really is. Yeah,
no, I mean, I think a lot of this happened during the pandemic where, I mean, look, I didn't really think that much about masks, like during the first year of the pandemic. You know, I wore my mask and whatever. And then I would say, like, towards the end of 2020, so towards the end of the first year of the pandemic, I was running into too many physicians who were experts in clinical trials or who had done, like, had academic experience running clinical trials. They're like, yeah, masks don't really work. People are just wearing them anyway. And that made me look into a little bit more about what was going on. And then also I noticed that this term conspiracy theory is being thrown around left and right, no matter what. You know, and then how these fact checkers were just screwing things up left and right and getting things wrong, even though they're supposed to be like, you know, we're a fact checker. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, I don't think they kind of knew something weird was happening, but they didn't really grasp like the totality of what it was. And it's like, okay, this makes me feel weird. Like, is this true? And I think it's funny. I think we're left with that to this day where I think this pandemic really turned a lot of people inside out, and now they're having serious problems when they read things, you know, knowing what's going on, like whether it's true or not, because they realize that for a lot of instances on issues during the pandemic, we were given bad information and then told that the people who were saying, actually, that's not true, but they were the ones putting out the misinformation,
yeah.
You know, and this went on for like 4 years, you know, it's kind of insane.
I want to get on to science journalism now. Have you seen any, I guess, you know, move back to more sort of honest reporting on science in the period of time, I don't know, as people are waking up? And because I'm noticing there are a lot more pieces being written now that are kind of more upfront about what might have happened here, and that's something I've noticed, that there's been a change. Has there been?
I don't think so. I think in the science writing community, I say that the science writers write for science, not on science. You know, their job is to basically be the public face of the science. You know, that they love, like, I'm going to explain you up all this complicated stuff, you know. So they see their job as being, you know, like marketers for science. Like, that's how they see themselves and view themselves. And it's the posture that they always take. There hasn't been any attempt to go back. I mean, it's just an example. I mean, I'll give you an example. The woman who runs Scientific American is a complete loon. Her name is Laura Helmuth. I've worked for her for the past. I've written stuff for her in the past when she was at Slate, and I've known her, like, you know, for a long time over the years, like off and on, you know, running in similar circles. She's a complete lunatic. She went over the edge on so many issues during the pandemic, and the BMJ just had a piece out, I would say about like 6 weeks ago or something like that, and they were looking at why this thing called the CAST report, which is a report that came out of England. And
yeah, we know about that. Yeah, we know about the CAST report. Yeah.
So it looked at whether using puberty blockers or using surgery for kids that were having issues with their gender, whether that was, whether there's any evidence for going through with using these therapies. And they found that there wasn't, like, the quality was low. It seems like what happened for a long time, people just were screwing up. They're putting kids on puberty blockers, giving them gender reassignment surgery, and just the whole thing was just a screw up and a mess. that was done without very little evidence. And just, it became like, I don't know, weird political movement. I think also in the States, I'll bet you there's a ton of money involved. Get these kids on these, you know, on these hormones, then, you know, the surgeries are expensive. So this article in the BMJ was looking at why this, you know, report was rejected in the United States. It was like mostly just ignored, or else it was, you know, there were pile-ons against it from these, you know, transgender activists. And in the process, they tripped over the fact that Laura Helmuth had, running Scientific American, had tweeted out like on, like over the last handful of years, like on 15 different occasions, things like denigrating people who question transgender therapy, or saying like with all this great confidence that transgender therapy is great for kids, and this is what the science says. Like, it's so crazy and lunatic. And of course, she's not gone back and, you know, bitten back any of that stuff. She's not bitten back any of the stupid stuff that she's, you know, done on masks, any of the stupid things that she said about vaccines. And I think that, you know, this is kind of how this group of people, I call them science writers, not journalists, because they don't do any actual reporting. They just write things. I think this is how they are. It's who gets attracted into this. Into this type of, you know, this particular niche, and also like the herd mentality that they have, you know, within themselves.
Trust seems to be a big issue. I'm hearing people all the time. It's totally anecdotal, I know, but I know it's far and wide. Trust is gone. Trust in science, trust in doctors, trust in any sort of expert. There's been a complete crumbling of trust, hasn't there? Do you think there's any chance that can be rebuilt in any time? Because there's a downside to not trusting, but there's also an upside, I suppose. But it's been torn to shreds, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the trust in pretty much everything, you know, it's interesting, like watching this kind of play out in America right now. You know, we have a presidential election right now, and what's interesting is how little trust there is in either of the parties, in either the Republican or Democratic Party, but also in the media. But yeah, I mean, the media deserves it. I mean, they worked hard to destroy trust in the public. You know, they've spit out nothing but total garbage. I'll give you just an example right now. This is like another example of, you know, what's happening. It's not about science, but it's about what's happening like every day in the media in America because of this election. You know, we now have these two candidates running. The Republican is Donald Trump, and the Democrat is Kamala Harris. And what's interesting about all the journalists now telling you or writing these stories like about what a great person Kamala Harris is, were the same ones that were basically either ignoring or denying the fact that Joe Biden has dementia. You know, same group of people, right?
Yeah.
And so what's playing out right now is it's become this kind of personality test. And you know it is because, you know, you've got one guy, a candidate named Donald Trump, you know, whether you like him or dislike him or, you know, whatever it is. But he you know, talks to the media whenever he can. He can't shut up and not talk to the media. No. He has a platform and policies about what he's going to do. And so what does the media do? The media ignores the platform that Donald Trump has, right, for what the issue is going to run on. And instead, they're obsessed with this other project put together by the Heritage Foundation called Project 2025. Now, the Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank, one of the many in D.C. that is, you know, aligned with conservative issues, the Republican Party. And so they ignore what Donald Trump's platform is. And instead, they obsess over Project 2025, which Donald Trump has actually said, that's not my platform. Like, here's my platform. That's what they want to do, and that's fine. But like, here's my policies. So they ignore that, right? And they want to focus instead on Project 2025. This has become an issue like within the last, I would say, 3 weeks, where you read nothing but story after story about Project 25, repetitive stories about Project 25, when it's not his platform, right? It's so insane. Meanwhile, the other candidate, Kamala Harris, will not give the interviews and does not have a policy platform at all. I mean, you go to her website and it's literally just a fundraiser. It's just like, you know, you can donate money to my campaign. It was so funny because when she picked this guy, Waltz, as her vice president, I saw the tweet, and the tweet, instead of actually doing what normally happens during a campaign where, you know, you pick someone for vice president or there's a big announcement and then you hold a press conference, right? She didn't hold a press conference because she doesn't want to take questions from the media, and she doesn't want to be in a situation where everything's unscripted. What she does is she puts on Twitter and come join us for an online fundraiser. And I was like, wait, hold on here. You pick this guy and your first thing to do is like, come on now, give me more money. Like, it's so crazy. It's so insane. But that's kind of like, you know, where we're at in America right now, you know, where we've got one candidate who doesn't have a platform. No one knows what she thinks, but, and she's constantly, you know, all she does is campaign rallies and fundraisers. Will not talk to the media. The media is in love with her. The other guy will talk to the media if you were to call Donald Trump right now, he'd probably put you through, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure he wouldn't. Yeah.
I mean, it's just so crazy. The guy's like completely transparent and he's got a platform, but no one talks about it. Instead, they talk about this other thing that's not his platform. So like, that's what American media is right now. You know, that's where we're at.
It sounds like they all sit down together and sort of make out the plan. Do you think it's like that? Because that lockstep that you just described, and that's what I picked up, is, you know, requires, you know, a plan, a strategy. And if there is one, where's it coming from? How top down is it? Who's up there coordinating this?
What they're doing is they're all getting the same press releases from the Democrats and the Republicans. They're ignoring what the Republicans, you know, are telling. They run immediately to the Democrats. I mean, this is hilarious. So, you know, Elon Musk just interviewed or did this like campaign thing with Donald Trump on Spaces on X. I think it was just yesterday.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, everyone, you know, made fun of it and this is crazy and blah, blah, blah. I think it had something like a billion people now have like, you know, or have either watched portions of it or seen things about it or whatever. And something, I mean, tens of millions of people actually watched it. Okay. I'm not saying the whole time, but like tens of millions of people like tuned in at some point in time. And Elon Musk tweeted out just yesterday screenshots of all the stories about him and Donald Trump having this talk that went on for like 2 hours, something like that. And it's so funny because you could just read the headlines one after the other, like, okay, so here's the Hollywood Reporter. Elon Musk got EU disinformation warning before a rambling Donald Trump interview on X. Here's CNN. Like watching grumpy old men, columnist on Trump's X conversation with Musk. Here's the Washington Post. Trump returns to X with technical glitches, softball questions from Musk. Here's the Atlantic. Elon Musk throws a Trump rally. The New York Times, must Trump talk on X after glitchy start, a 2 hour ramble. So it's just like, I mean, none of them cared about like, they're just like, okay, what headline can I write? Like that this is stupid. That like, this is like, you know, I doubt that any of them even really tuned in to listen to what he had to say. They went in, figured, okay, how do I spin this? What do I do? And in part it's because, you know, they're all reading each other, you know, like, I mean, all these reporters are get up in the morning and they're seeing like, okay, if I'm at the New York Times, what did the Post write? What did the Journal write? What did the Atlantic write? Oh, I can take that. I can take that thing that appeared in Vox. Like, oh, that's a good idea. Let me take that. So they're all kind of just reading each other. So it's all this kind of like, they're all being fed kind of similar information. And then they're all in a room kind of reading and talking to each other, you know, and that's what's going on, you know?
Yeah, that's that derangement syndrome, isn't it?
Well, I call it, so the thing is Trump derangement syndrome. And I call what these people are, I call it, or TDS. I call them TDS long haulers.
Yeah, like long COVID.
Oh, yeah. TDS long haulers.
Elon Musk and X, that's changed the game, though, hasn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, what's happened is, you know, the Democrats, I wouldn't say necessarily the party, but I would say them and, you know, similar ideologically aligned groups kind of had control of X, you know, when it was called Twitter. And you can tell this because, you know, they deny up and down that like that's the case, but, you know, they were freaked out over the fact that like Elon Musk was coming in. And it's like, okay, well, you know, if you don't have control over it, then why are you worried about people taking this thing away from you? And it's because they had control over it, right? I mean, they totally had control over it. And, you know, and now they don't, and it's moved back towards the center. And so because it's now moved back towards the center, the only thing they can do is kind of say, oh, it's right wing, it's filled with disinformation. And then they all flee to Blue Sky, which I call, MAGA Blue. You know, that's where all like the ones who are just, you know, anti-MAGA, I call them MAGA Blue. You know, they're all sitting, you know, now on Blue Sky talking to themselves, patting each other on the back, amplifying each other's bullshit. So they just move themselves into a smaller room because they don't want to mix with anyone who thinks differently than they do. So this is now where a lot of the reporters are, a lot of the academics, they're all kind of hanging out on Blue Sky and talking amongst themselves and telling each other how smart they are and commiserating over the fact that like they can't control what the public thinks anymore.
Yeah, to the public, maybe you can, you know, give a bit of your advice or knowledge to members of our audience who, you know, they might struggle to discern what to believe and what not to, what's credible, not credible in science journalism and reporting. Are there things to look out for that are like tells on whether, you know, something is less than accurate, let's say, or is more about that sort of science, that niche of science communication than journalism? What are your thoughts on that? Are there keywords? Are there ways that, you know, the stories are written that, you know, will ring bells or feel credible?
I mean, what I tell people is that, you know, so there's a lot of people out there now who are just like, the mainstream media is lying all the time. And that's true. But there's also a lot of stuff in there that's also true. And what you're trying to do is pick apart like what's real and what's just complete total bullshit. And that's hard. You know, it's like you can't just say like anything that's not mainstream is suddenly true, because that's not true either. Like there's a lot of stuff in alternative media that's not, you know, one of the major networks and one of the main newspapers that's also bullshit. So you have to be careful. And, you know, my advice is, you know, if you find someone that you know is consistently getting things right, I think follow those people. And those people can be found, you know, at, you know, big media outlets and at small media outlets. You know, there's at big media outlets, there's people who suck and there's people who are good. You know, there's a woman at the New York Times, Apoorva Mandavili, who was one of the main reporters for COVID. And anytime I see her byline, I'm just skeptical because I've seen her make so many mistakes. But I just know that because I've run across her stuff. So I know, like, you know, and I'm also someone inside the media. So, you know, it's just like my job is to be hyper aware of these things. I'm not an average person. Like, I'm not an average reader. But I think my main advice is, you know, read wisely, read widely, read from don't just wake up and read your newspaper and that's it, or have your one channel that you watch on TV. Like, try to get ideas from different sources, you know, and pick around to see what different ideas are out there. Because oftentimes what happens is, especially as the media is becoming more polarized, certain outlets just won't, it's not so much that they will cover things and put a bias on it. They simply just will not cover certain issues. They won't cover certain issues. They'll pretend it didn't happen. And that's the biggest bias. And so you'll totally miss that something happened, because where you go to get news, they're not going to write about it. And so you want to get, you know, broaden your reading. You know, I did this after 2016. You know, when I woke up the morning after the election and I saw that Donald Trump was president, I was like, how did I not see this coming? And I didn't see it coming because the media outlets that I was reading, which I was mostly going to, which is the New York Times and the Washington Post, they were totally biased against Trump, you know? And so I just, in my head, because of what I was reading, I just couldn't imagine that he was ever going to become president. Well, what I realized is that the Post and the New York Times were obviously way out of touch with the voters. And, you know, I was more interested in what the voters thought than what the New York Times and what the Washington Post thought. And so what I did at that point is I started reading different media outlets. I started reading more conservative media outlets. I started going and find things that, you know, that said things that I wasn't sure if were true or not, but I was trying to figure out like where they were getting their information from. So that's my main advice. Read widely, read wisely.
A couple of final questions before we wrap up the chat. It's been fascinating, by the way. In terms of science journalism, it seems to me to be a very good way to disseminate misinformation as a vehicle.
Do you think? Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there. I'll give you one of the biggest examples of, you know, and this is actually a science issue that science journalists do not understand. You know, I wrote a law in the U.S. called the Physician Payment Sunshine Act, which is now called Open Payments. And what that law was about was the committee I was working for in the Senate. We kept running across bad drugs that were ending up on the market. And then when we look at how these drugs ended up on the market or why were they sold so widely, we found out it's because a lot of these doctors were being paid by the pharmaceutical industry. And we were like, okay, well, how do we create a systemic fix that will not deal with each and every individual drug, but that will deal with the problem itself? And so we worked and then passed a law called the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. And you can now look up doctors to see which companies are paying them. The companies have to report when they give, you know, money to doctors to give talks, or they take them out to dinner, or they fly them on vacations, whatever it is that they're doing with them. And this has to do with an issue called conflicts of interest. And this is an issue, and it's an area of research, actually. Most science journalists do not understand conflicts of interest. They've totally screwed it up during this pandemic. If you'll notice, you've never seen a single story, and I don't know if it exists or not, about a scientist who was promoting the vaccines who was taking money from the vaccine manufacturers.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
I don't think that popped up once. I saw one article that a guy named Li Fang wrote, who I don't remember if he was at The Intercept or not, or if he'd left, but he went and dug through Pfizer stuff and found out all these nursing groups and everything that were paid all this money to go and promote the vaccines, right? So during this entire COVID, they acted like something they knew, right? Which everyone understands that the pharmaceutical industry pays off doctors to serve as marketers for their products. That idea suddenly disappeared, right? This knowledge that we had that this is how the pharmaceutical industry works, that knowledge disappeared during the pandemic, right? And suddenly other doctors, right, were suddenly accused of conflicts of interest when they didn't have any. Like, it's like, well, why'd you do this? Like, oh, there's this conflict of interest here. And it was just totally, totally, and totally made up. You know, this happened with a lot of physicians and stories that appeared in Scientific American, in stories that appeared on BuzzFeed, where conflicts of interest were simply just made up because the reporter didn't like someone and they said, aha, he's got a conflict of interest. So they'll just make stuff up. I honestly don't have much hope for science. I mean, I'm kind of done with them. Like, I know so many of these people and I'm just like, you people suck. Like, I mean, I will even tell them to their face, you're not a journalist, you're a science writer. You know, you're not.
Yeah. You going back to what you said, yeah. Gosh, it's all sort of, you know, it's clown world. And I just want to ask you about, does peer review mean anything anymore?
Well, I wrote a piece, actually, I wish you'd asked me this before, I could have pulled it up, the Washington Post, about 2019 or something like that. And it was me and this other researcher who had become concerned about all these people yammering on about peer review. And I mean, it is considered the gold standard. But, you know, I mean, look, there's a history of, I think, even Nobel Prize winners who initially, when they tried to get their research published, it was rejected, right? I mean, there's a history of this stuff. There's a history of garbage that has been peer reviewed, and then it's just total garbage. I mean, there was a lot of articles during COVID that we know those articles were total garbage. They were peer reviewed by journals, and everyone knows today that this research is garbage, but it fit a narrative that the scientists wanted to believe. And the thing I like to tell people is that people think that science is this, like, there's this like process that happens. Like, no, it's a process made up of people. And so embedded within the scientific process is all the problems of people, right? Greed, narcissism, fear, right? All the deadly sins that we know are in people are embedded within the scientific process. And so it's a process that is made up of people, right? Who, you know, have problems. And so it has those problems embedded within it, you know? And so, I mean, peer review is, it's a good process, But, you know, I mean, if when there are journals that want to let stuff through, it gets through. You know, I mean, that's just like when there's political pressure to let something in, to say, like, we believe this, you know, it will get published. I mean, there's one example early on during the pandemic where I uncovered all the emails. There was an article that appeared in this. It's an unknown journal called Emerging Microbes and Infections. And what the emails show is that these virologists were putting together an essay in Emerging Microbes and Infections. They all had ties to Wuhan, to the Wuhan lab, right? They actually even had Shi Zeng Li, the woman running the Wuhan lab, edit the piece for them. They sent it to her secretly. She's not on the paper. They sent it to her secretly, right? They also had a guy named Ralph Barrick, who's at University of North Carolina. He's one of the main guys working with Shi Zeng Li at Wuhan. They had him look at it, and he came back to them, right? We have the copies of this. You can see his track changes when he sent the manuscript back to them. And then he even tells them, he says, I don't want to be, I'm going to get this somewhat off, but like, I don't want to be cited in as having, you know, been involved in this. So he tells them, like, I don't be, and of course he's not mentioned. He's not an author, even though he helped to write it. He's not mentioned in the acknowledgments. And in one of the emails, the woman says, well, when I tried to do like a super fast peer review, which is almost not even a peer review. So this article gets published. I send the emails to the publisher, right, of the journal. They don't do anything, you know? And this article, which is in a very, you know, a pretty much unknown journal outside of virology, became one of their top 10 most downloaded pieces of 2020.
Oh, man.
Gee. Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. They were actually praised for it by the publisher later. You know, there's an email where the publisher's like, you guys did a great job. This thing got 75,000 downloads or however many it was. This is one of our most important pieces we put out this year, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, you know, it's a process made up of, the peer review process is made up of people, and, you know, people are people.
Yeah. That was really interesting, Paul Thacker, investigative science journalist, and the people are people. What a great way to end. Thank you for beaming in from Spain to talk with us this morning on our radio stations. Great.
Thanks. And I hope everyone please sign up and read my newsletter, The Disinformation Chronicle.
I really hope we'll chat again. I'm sure we will. All the best in the meantime. And keep on doing what you're doing, man.
Thanks so much. Have a great day, everyone.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.